Welcome to the Teaching Exceptional Children's Podcast. The mission of this podcast is to help close the research to practice gap for practitioners in special education by creating a platform to facilitate conversations with key scholars in the field regarding the latest publications in the journal, as well as using the journal for professional development. You're probably wondering who I am. My name is Christina Eagle, and I'm a PhD student at George Mason University. Part of my role at Mason is to be an editorial assistant for the journal, under the guidance of our wonderful team of editors, including Dr. Kenya Cornelius, Dr. Shaquana Freeman-Green, and Dr. Pamela Williamson. I am honored to be the host of Teaching Exceptional Children's Podcast, and I can't wait for you to be a part of this journey with us. Thanks for listening. Now let's get started. Welcome to the new episode of Teaching Exceptional Children's Podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about evidence-based practices. We have a panel of guest editors, and I'm very excited to jump into this issue. Before I do, I want to take a moment to introduce our impressive panel today. First, we have Dr. Lauren Collins from San Diego State University. Dr. Collins' research focuses on students with emotional and behavioral disorders, effective teaching practices, addressing behaviors within the classroom, and the use of evidence-based practices. Thank you for being here, Dr. Collins. Next, we are delighted to have Dr. Sarah Cook from University of Hawaii at Manoa. And you have as well have research interests in evidence-based practices for high-incidence disabilities, teacher preparation, inclusive classroom practices, and have taught courses in secondary language arts and math in inclusive settings. Thank you for being here, Dr. Sarah Cook. Last, but definitely not least, we have Dr. Brian Cook from the University of Virginia. If you're a doctoral student like myself, you have spent some time reading Dr. Cook's work, especially regarding evidence-based practices and research in special education. In addition to this, you have an interest in open science, crowdsourcing in education, research, and researching research. Dr. Brian Cook, thank you so much for being here. Now let's jump into this episode. All right, so today we have so much to talk about, and I want to take a moment to explain the structure of today's podcast. Our guests who serve as guest editors for this issue, we will first start talking about the issue itself, and then we will jump into the featured article, Practice You Can Trust, Making Research Accessible for Special Educators. I'd like to begin with the theme of the issue, which is evidence-based practices. Dr. Brian Cook, I was hoping you could start us off and explain to our listeners who may be new to the field, what are evidence-based practices and why are they so important in the classroom?
Sure. Thanks, Christina. I think evidence-based practices that we sometimes abbreviate as EBPs, they try to answer one of those age-old questions in education and special education. What works instead of educators having to just kind of try practices out to see if they work? We do have lots of research, which is a pretty reliable, trustworthy way to investigate what works generally. And so really, generally, evidence-based practices are instructional practices and techniques that are supported by research evidence as being effective. But when we really kind of get into it and start to think about it, that begs the question of what kind of research, how much research, how effective does the research have to show a practice to be able to identify something as an evidence-based practice? And so a lot of different organizations and groups of scholars have developed standards, which differ in some specific ways, but they really overlap significantly in their content to identify EBPs in special education. And So generally speaking, across these different standards, they require that an evidence-based practice be supported by multiple high-quality experimental studies that show meaningfully improved outcomes for students as a result of the practice. And then a practice, when they meet those, when a research base meets those standards, a practice is classified as being an evidence-based practice for a particular group of learners for a particular outcome. And so when we have that strong research base behind a practice, we can have a lot of confidence that the evidence that an evidence-based practice is generally effective for a group or groups of learners. And so that kind of gives us a really good place to start in terms of our instructional decisions. We can have a lot of confidence that these practices are generally effective for a group of learners that we're trying to teach. And so I guess that goes to why evidence-based practices are can be helpful or useful or important in the classroom. And I'll just comment, this is just obviously a brief introduction, but a couple important limitations around evidence-based practices too that I try to mention whenever I talk and write about evidence-based practices. Evidence-based practices are generally effective. They work for most kids in the research studies, but nothing works for everyone. And so we can't assume that even though a practice is identified as an evidence-based practice, and that's really useful and helpful to know, we can't assume that, well, this is obviously going to work for everyone. It's identified as an evidence-based practice. And with that knowledge, we still have to do effective special education and effective teaching, which includes good progress monitoring and assessment and behavior management, and think about how we're going to get the resources to implement a practice with, in this case, an evidence-based practice, with fidelity over time. Evidence-based practices inform just kind of one part of good special education teaching, that part of where we decide what practice to use. But there's still a whole lot of other decisions, and there's a lot of other things still going on in effective special education. So this is just one piece of the pie in terms of effective special education teaching. And I guess the last limitation I'll throw out is that our research base is growing all the time, and we're doing lots of different reviews and syntheses, researchers are, to identify more and more evidence-based practices. But evidence-based practice is a way to kind of estimate or to classify the effectiveness of a practice based on the research base. And we have a limited research base. We just don't have huge bodies of high quality experimental research on every practice out there. And so just because you might not see that a practice you're interested in has been systematically identified as being evidence-based, doesn't mean that it's not effective necessarily. It may mean that we just haven't done enough research on that practice to know whether it's evidence-based or not. Generally speaking, an evidence-based practice is something that has been shown by multiple high-quality experimental studies to work for a group of learners. And what a great place to start from if you're making instructional decisions for kids with disabilities, to know that this is a practice that might not work for everybody, but research has shown that it's generally effective for kids like the ones I teach. And so I think that's what evidence-based practices are, and why they're important.
That's awesome. I think one thing that I was thinking about as you're speaking is also this idea of thinking about the how teaching is both an art form, right, and a science. And I think that when you were talking, I was thinking about that balance, right, of like not only or can you be a talented teacher, but you can implement powerful tools that have shown progress for students. So that's what I was thinking of when you were talking.
I think it's such a great point. And evidence-based practice is not unique to special education or education. It was probably popularized in medicine in the 90s to start with, and then grew out to many other fields, including special education. And pretty predictably, when evidence-based practices become popularized in a field, there's a reaction to them among a lot of practitioners. And this happened with medical doctors who said, wait a second, I don't want to be kind of dictated how I practice medicine, that there's these decisions based on my experience and my interaction and my with my clients, in our case students, and my expertise. And I don't want to just be told I have to do these specific practices because that's what the research base says. And I think that's such an important point. Evidence-based practices are really part of a larger process of effective special education, teaching and instruction. They're just a really great place to kind of start from and to inform our good instruction that has so many different components to it. But if we can start from a place of these are generally effective practices, can make probably a good teacher that much more effective.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. Dr. Collins, the issue highlights different areas of the field of special education. The articles include strategy, instruction in mathematics and reading for students with learning disabilities, practical implementation of best practices for check-in, check-out for students with and at risk for emotional and behavior disorders. Application of time delay to teach students with extensive support needs, technology-based communication interventions for students who are deaf-blind, and using video modeling to teach students with autism. What struck me about this issue is not only the range of topics, but also the populations of students addressed within the articles. Can you walk me through your thinking in curating this issue and what was important to you?
Sure. So I think it might be helpful to have a little bit of background on a project that sort of led to this special issue coming to fruition. We had been working separately on synthesizing evidence-based reviews that had been published in peer-reviewed journals. So we were doing a mega review of EBPs, and our goal was to try to identify what has been, classified as an evidence-based practice in special education across all disability areas. So as we're working on that, we're seeing a lot of really cool things start to surface. We're getting a lot of data, but the flip side always, I think that, in academia, especially in the world of special education, and those of us are teacher educators, is we have to get that information to the people that are in the classrooms that can take these practices and interventions and really make the outcome on the kids with disabilities. And so, after we finished that project, we're like, how can we get as many teachers as possible with as many, how can we provide, excuse me, as many teachers as possible with as many opportunities as they can to support the most students possible, right? The wide range. So not every teacher is teaching, a single categorical classroom. You might have students with a wide range of disabilities. So for that reason, it was really important that the special issue, as much as it could possibly, reflected the diversity of the populations of kids who are receiving services. And so as we curate the issue, we looked at, what our data were showing, and we tried to choose practices that we felt like would have the broadest reach and the most impact. And after we did that, we started thinking about, okay, how will this look? And so we wanted to keep cohesion across every article. So we sort of developed this kind of a loose framework, but really we were like, we're going to ask authors to briefly summarize the research evidence because, you know, in the spirit of TEC, we want the articles to be heavily focused on application, right? An article that you can read today and in a couple, within a few days, be implementing some of those key takeaway steps in your classroom. But at the same time, we think it's important for teachers also to know, don't just do this because we're telling you, right? We're suggesting this because there's a really solid body of evidence support to support it. And we are so fortunate that we've got a pretty great network of researchers in our own professional networks. And so we started reaching out to some of the top researchers in the field who are also remarkable translators of that research into practice. And we invited them to participate in each writing an article about a specific practice for a specific population of learners. And something else that was really cool about this issue is after a meeting with the editors of TEC, we encouraged all of the authors to collaborate with practitioners in the development of those articles so that we could really make sure that we're reflecting and elevating the voices of people that are currently or recently had been practicing special education.
Yeah, one of the things that also like looking just what you said of like we in the school system we have so many different kinds of needs, right? And sometimes I think on the teacher end we can feel isolated in that, hey, I might not know exactly what to do for this student. And so I thought what a beautiful way of putting things in teachers' hands that supports them in reaching the students that they want to reach. So thank you for that. Dr. Sarah Cook, as you look at this issue as a whole, what do you hope teachers take away?
I'm really excited. You know, in my work, and I think all of our work with in-service and pre-service teachers, right, and talking about evidence-based practices, how many times have we heard, well, where is the list, right? Where is the list of practices and how do I get my hands on it? And so I think for us, as we did this research, like we got really excited about contributing to that list of evidence-based practices. So I think above all, like I really do hope that, you know, the readers of TEC find this special issue practical and useful in helping them identify and select evidence-based practices to integrate into their classrooms to provide specialized instruction for students with disabilities. So that excites me. And I think, you know, maybe somebody reading through the special issue will find one of the articles and be like, oh my gosh, this practice aligns exactly with what I need in my classroom. I'm trying to figure out a practice for behavior or math, and I really need to implement this practice immediately. But maybe others are reading through the issue and reading our article, and they've just come across a reliable online resource that they hadn't heard about, right? So I think there's different ways that I think practitioners can engage with this special issue. And I think, as Lauren mentioned earlier, we really did try to figure out a way to present the information in this issue so that it can reach multiple types of teachers that work with different populations of students. So we're just really excited about it.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I think one of the things I'm so excited to also talk about is the feature article, which is the evidence-based practices you can trust in special education. And when I looked at the article, I was like, where has this article been my whole life? Because you outline a five-step framework that teachers, instructional coaches, mentors, and teacher educators can use to implement evidence-based practices. And as we've talked about in this session, that evidence-based practices can feel sometimes like formal and not accessible to a teacher who is just, you know, dealing with all the 10,000 things that come at them during a school day. So first, walk us through those first 5 steps, and then we will go into the tools that you laid out within the article.
Okay, sure. So I would like to say I do not have words to describe how happy it makes me to hear that that was your reaction as you were reading the article. I remember like 13, 14 years ago now being a doc student, and my tiny little was more reflective of a closet than an office, and reading through it and going, oh my gosh, like where is the list? You know, and drawing on my own experience as a classroom teacher too, always looking for things you could find. And I was coming across all this research and going, I wish I had had this when I was a teacher. And so this has really been something I have wanted to do, and I think others on this call have also been interested in putting out there for some time now. So thank you for sharing that you enjoyed the article. Okay. So for the framework, I mentioned that we had been in the process of, you know, working on another project, a systematic review of evidence-based practices. And there have certainly been other organizations or groups that have put out, you know, lists of evidence-based practices or resources for them. So really, we're hoping that this article would be a complement to what's already out there. But also, what's unique is that we're really synthesizing across the disability areas and then specifically practices that have been identified in peer-reviewed journals. So when we started thinking about it, we're like, how can we take this list that we've got and then turn this into an article? And so we decided to approach it from the angle of an instructional coach or a teacher mentor. So how might those who are working with special ed teachers support them in choosing the correct practice and then implementing it and monitoring the effectiveness of that in their own classrooms? So really briefly, I can go through the 5 steps, and then as you mentioned, Sarah will elaborate on some of the tools that we've got in just a second. But the first step is determining students' instructional needs. So essentially figuring out what are your students working on, getting really clear about the goals that are being prioritized and where you need to put in some efforts to figure out where those gaps need to be bridged and shortened a little bit. And then after you've got the instructional goal, you can start moving toward, okay, now it's time to pick a practice. And provide some targeted intervention. And so in the article, we suggest there's, you know, 2 different ways you could do this. One is by using the table that we provide in our article of all of the different evidence-based practices. And then another is using some online resources to maybe try to choose practices if the practice you're looking for or if the need that you have isn't reflected on our list. And so one of the goals with that second table is the internet's a great tool. It can be really overwhelming, and there's also some information, you know, out there that teachers can come across that might not be the most reliable. So our hope was to find a really reliable set of resources to say, if you get stuck, take this with you. Here's a place to look. And then the third step is to figure out what you need to support implementation. And this is going to look different for every teacher, right? In some cases, choosing a practice on that list might be, oh, this is a new practice I haven't tried. It might just, looking at that list, might jog your memory of, oh my gosh, I forgot about using check in, check out. I learned about that in my teacher prep program. I forgot about that. Because oftentimes, as special ed teachers, we know you are in the weeds every day. And it can get really easy to forget what you were taught when you're just trying to survive. And so maybe it jogs your memory. So the third step is to figure out your own, or help the person you're coaching figure out their own level of support that's needed to successfully implement that practice. So that might look like finding a technical assistance center. It might look like getting a resource that we've suggested that gives steps for implementation, right? So our article provides the framework of here's the practices, but there's more work to be done in terms of now how do we implement them. After that, it's to provide training and coaching. If you're a special ed teacher, though, who's reading this article, determine if you need some more training and coaching. And we suggest using things like self-assessment and performance feedback to really shore up the implementation of those practices. And then finally, the last step that we suggest is to use database decision making. So, as Brian mentioned, unfortunately, we do not have a single practice that's going to work for every student every single time, but evidence-based practices are our best shot. That being said, we still need to monitor how students are responding to those interventions and that instruction. And so step 5 is really about teachers collecting their own data to determine whether an intervention needs to be continued or changed based on how their student is responding.
It is really a one-stop shop, right? In an article, which is really awesome and really user-friendly for everyone. So in table one, and you talked a little bit about this, but table one provides teachers a framework of how to sort through the evidence-based practices to aid in making educational decisions about who might benefit from it and how it can be implemented. Can you walk us through this first table and how it would improve selecting evidence-based practices? And just for our listeners, it starts out with the evidence-based practices, and then there are different various columns that talk about what skills would be utilized within that evidence-based practice.
Yeah, so just to remind listeners, when we're looking at table one, that list of practices is from what Lauren mentioned earlier, right? These are evidence-based practices that we found through that are published in peer-reviewed journals, right? And there are so many online resources as well that provide lists of what's effective for students with disabilities. So many of us are familiar with the What Works Clearinghouse or the Evidence for ESSA website, or even the National Professional Development Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder, right? Those are really great online resources that teachers can access to find evidence-based practices. But the challenge, right, is that there's a lot of researchers out there doing work and review evidence-based reviews that are being published in peer-reviewed journals that are a lot harder to find, right? Because they're published across so many different journals. So it's hard for individual teachers to go find that information. So that's what's in table one. So that's kind of our two, right? Like, here are all the evidence-based reviews that we found in peer-reviewed research. So that's kind of the first column. So what we wanted to do in this article is we worked with our colleague, Dr. Chris Swigert, and he helped us kind of organize. Instead of throwing out a list of here's this many evidence-based practices, we wanted table one to be kind of a snapshot of what the practices are and what they're intended to do and who they're intended, or I guess let me rephrase that. What the practices are intended, what educational outcomes are they intended to improve and for whom, right? Whom have they been proven to be effective for? So when you look at table one for us, I think it's a kind of a first glance of being able to kind of look through this set of practices, and you can use it, as Lauren kind of indicated earlier, in different ways, right? So if I'm a practitioner and I'm looking for perhaps a math intervention, right? I can look at table one and I can go through the practices and I can look at the column related to math outcomes and I can kind of go through it that way. I can also glance at the table and see, oh, what practices are out there that have been shown to be effective for students with learning disabilities or students with autism. So there's different ways to look and use table one, but I think for me, and maybe Lauren or Brian can chime in on this, but I think it's kind of that first glance of just kind of how we organize those practices so it just wasn't a running list of all of the practices we found in the research.
I think you captured that, Sarah. I think that was one of the benefits too of having Dr. Swigert help us. He's a practitioner, and so kind of bringing that lens back in and saying organizing it in this way is going to be the fastest way. And basically, his thing was when teachers come to me, right? Here's what they're saying: I've got a student struggling in this outcome area. Right. And so then it's like, oh, okay, so let's start with the outcome areas. And then now you can go down that and see where is the evidence that shows this has been effective and for whom, and then go from there.
That's a really good point, Sarah and Lauren. And I think one of the things that may be on the horizon for the future of evidence-based practices are how we organize and disseminate evidence-based practice, because this huge list, these big lists of practices, it's not always clear. And I think teachers, for the most part, want more granular, specific context, specific information Does it work for this type of kid, for this type of outcome, in this type of setting? And I think more research is needed to start to answer those questions. And then I think we're going to have to think and experiment with how to organize and present that most effectively. When I go to the doctor now, and you go in and you say, "Well, what's going on with this? I feel this pain here," and they punch it into a computer and it comes out, "This is probably what is going on, and these are the recommended practices." I think that, and again, not to be prescriptive to teachers and necessarily say, "Well, this is what you have to do," but to say, both with our assessments and then with our interventions and instruction, this is what we think is going on, and here are some research validated approaches to try to address that. I think this is an initial effort down that road to start thinking about how to organize this growing body of information in a way that's meaningful and useful for educators.
Yeah, and I think that when you're talking about, I think a lot of times about with research, right? Like we have we've gone through this extensive process, we've had rigor, but getting it into people's hands is just so important. And this really moves it into teachers and giving them a way to process not just one practice, right? But many to give also people options, right? And choice. I think that that is also really, really cool.
And I think that emphasis on options and choice is really important, and starts to get away from that feeling of, "Oh, I'm being constrained by, I have to do practice X or Y because that's the only thing on this list." The more practices we have that are validated as effective by research, we're just giving teachers options that have been teachers and other educational professionals, options that have been vetted and validated as generally effective.
So in table two, you compiled a list of evidence-based practices and research, and in table three, you curated reliable online resources. I think that this is huge for teachers, right? Because even if we think about like AI, right, we don't even know if they're vetted, right? Or getting that information out. So we need information in one place that we can rely on. And I was hoping that you could elaborate on these tables within the article and how they could be used in concert with one another and how this can aid the implementation of evidence-based practices.
Yeah, and I think we've alluded to throughout this session, right, that it's really daunting to try to figure out where to find all of the effective practices and all of the reliable information. And I think special education teachers already have a lot on their plates, but even if they didn't, accessing research is challenging because many sources, right? There's a lot of great reliable online resources, but a lot of the research that's published is also kind of behind paid subscription, firewall, right? All of those things. And so when we pulled this together, I think Christina, you mentioned like a one-stop shop. I think it's important to note that these resources are not exhaustive, right? There are things out there, but it is kind of this first kind of step of a starting place of where special education teachers may want to go. So if we mentioned, that kind of overview in table one, and then if you get into table two provides kind of the description, a brief description of each of the evidence-based practices that have made our list. And then we have table three that is a reliable resources. And the way that I kind of think about using this is in different ways, right? Maybe a practitioner starts with the list in table one, and they're thinking about looking through those and seeing if there's any practices that kind of align with what they're looking for their classroom. And maybe there is. That's great. And if there is, the problem is that That list isn't going to tell you how to implement the practice, right? It's going to tell you the practice. It's going to give you a little bit of information about who the practice has been shown to be effective for, but it doesn't give enough information to go out and teach it. And so, or to go out and use the practice. So we created Table 3 for that purpose. A lot of the reliable resources we have in Table 3 provide practitioners with materials and resources and more information. Other way is, you know, if you go through Table 1 and nothing is, you know, connecting with you, there are, again, the reliable resources that provide. So I think we have What Works Clearinghouse up there. We have the National Center, the National Professional Development Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder, right? We have other resources that will show you other practices. And so I think all of us would agree that using these in combination, teachers can probably find something that matches what they're looking for in terms of improving educational outcomes for students in their classes. But I think also what you mentioned earlier is fitting the context, right? We want to be able to have a practice that's flexible enough for us to implement into our daily routines and curriculum that fits our context and matches us. This shouldn't be like a prescription, right? Of you have to use all of these practices to be an effective teacher. That's not the purpose, right? What we're hoping that they use these practices for is thinking about, oh, when I'm designing and delivering specialized instruction, maybe I want to select an evidence-based practice so I can be most confident that that practice is going to help improve the student outcomes. Anything to add to that, Lauren, Brian?
Of course, I have something to add. So apologies if you did say this while I was looking it up. But I just wanted to point out that in Table 2, it's where we provide a description of those practices. So in some cases, Table 1, you know, you might be familiar with the practice that's listed. In others, you may never have heard of it. And so that was actually something we got feedback from reviewers on saying, this article, you know, it's missing something. We've got to be able to like read the article and know what the practice is as people are consuming it. And so that's where Table 2 came from, was our attempt to not only, you know, list what the practice is, but give a really short explanation of it and then some examples of evidence that supports the use of that practice. Sarah, did you say that? Was I repeating you? You did say that. Sorry.
No, that's okay. I think it's worthy of hearing it twice. And I also think that one of the things is that as teachers, educators, we are inundated with so much information and also practices and acronyms and all of these things. And so I have heard check in, check out so many times, but really not taking the time to really look at its definite, like a summary of it and what that looks like. And then, like, having that, oh, yeah, like that might work with so and so, or this might work for this class. And maybe I want to implement it here. So I think that those summaries really can resonate with people and also help teachers really dive in, because I know that feeling when you're standing at a clearinghouse and you're like paralyzed with like, what am I even searching for, right? So I think that this is a way to like to go in where put your feet in where the water is a little bit more shallow and you're understanding and you can see what's in front of you. So I think that is so cool. So after reading this article, I was thinking about the classrooms that I have taught in. And you know, we teachers, there's nothing I think more stressful than when you see a student in need and you're not sure the best way to reach them. And we want them to be their better and more skilled version of themselves after they leave our classrooms. And so I was thinking about that if you have an effective strategy and it has worked and has worked on student after student, and then you have this one student who it's that your effective strategy is just no longer working. What would be your best advice in that scenario? Maybe using the tools that you outlined.
Well, I think this goes back to what we've already touched on many times in the podcast already, that evidence-based practices are a really good place to start. They're kind of a good bet to make in terms of a practice being effective. But for any given student, we don't know how effective it's going to be. And in special education especially, we're just going to be dealing with and teaching and working with a lot of kids who are going to be who are going to be those non-responders. And so we should really not only we shouldn't think of this as just a, oh, well, what if a student isn't responsive? We should think about some of our students are going to be non-responsive, and we should be ready to identify that and then be ready to do something about it. And I think the field has made tremendous advances in recent decades about doing this systematically and doing it based on data. And I'm thinking in particular about the data-based intervention process that we're intervening, we're using in evidence-based practice, but we're systematically progress monitoring students. We're checking to see how they're doing. And if they're not progressing, if they're not on pace to meet their goal, then we can go back and we can make sure we're implementing with fidelity. We can think about adapting the practice in ways that maintain fidelity to the core elements of the practice, but also maybe make it fit better for them or for your classroom or for the instructor, and continue to progress monitor. And if they're not making adequate progress still, do diagnostic evaluations. And ultimately, if through our best efforts and trying to adapt, a practice isn't working, this student may be a non-responder, and we may need to move on to another evidence-based practice that hopefully now we're accruing this evidence base where we don't just have one option, but we have multiple options at our disposal. So I think this is where really we see that art and science really kind of merge together when we're doing effective special education, that we do have a systematic evidence-based part of the equation, but some of it is just really good teaching and experience and making those choices that work for this kid in your classroom and with you as a teacher.
Yeah, I think one of the things I think I got caught up in as a teacher, or probably may still do, is that not wanting to compromise the evidence-based practice in not making it personalized to the student, right? So that is really something that I think I have struggled with and grappled with in terms of wanting to make sure that I'm doing my best at keeping the evidence-based practice true to its nature, but also making it fit the student. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think we've kind of talked about this in our group and did a little bit of, work in this area and thinking about, I think one of things for when we're talking about the evidence-based practices that, come up in this list, they are more discrete practices, right? We're not talking about programs that are like scripted, right? They're smaller practices that you can integrate into your daily curriculum, but on the flip side, they do have core components, right? Like through research have been established as effective because we're implementing with fidelity and kind of following those steps. But I think on the flip side of that, like there are areas where we can think about using our professional judgment to enhance the practice, right? Perhaps using something like universal design for learning, right? Well, and we can maintain those core components, but adjust it enough to kind of meet the strengths or the preferences or the learning needs for our individual students. So it's that idea of, balancing implementation fidelity with professional judgment of knowing your kids, knowing your classroom, and being able to do that. And so I think, in the case of kind of like the practices in this special issue and the practices on the list, I think there is ways, right, where we can maintain those core components. But as teachers, we also know our students in our classroom and what may work from them. So it's kind of figuring out how to find that balance. I don't know if that's helpful, but.
Super helpful.
And
Super helpful.
I think that goes back to the point, just the importance of that progress monitoring as we adapt. There aren't clear empirically validated guidelines on how to adapt each evidence-based practice for each type of learner that you're going to encounter. So some of this is taking the evaluation and assessment data that you have, using your expertise and experience as an educator, and kind of making your best guess about how can I adapt this, but also be true to the core elements of the practice. And boy, that really points to the importance of having frequent, ongoing assessment data that we can track the progress of the student to see. Yes, this is the rate of progress is really picked up since we made this adaptation, or no, now it's even worse. And so that wasn't effective. We need to think about doing something more different with the student. And so this is some of, I think, where we're getting into more of the art of effective special education teaching, and that needs to interact with the science of effective special education teaching, which involves progress monitoring to enable us to do good database decision making.
Yeah, I think about it all the time of like sometimes even pairing a high interest picture or a theme or those things can make a difference when implementing these practices for a student who's maybe not willing to engage. That's the and I think what the beautiful thing that you're talking about is also like having some of that permission to make it an individualized, right? I think that teachers, we want to do things right, right? And so there's that, I think with evidence-based practices, sometimes we hold that and grapple with it, like I described. So thank you for giving us permission to also, make it our own and assess our students as we're going and monitoring that as well.
I think in some ways there shouldn't just be permission's hard because I also want to balance that, but then don't just go wholesale changes because then you're not doing the evidence-based practice. But I think some level of adaptation is not only permissible, but it's desirable. I think it can help in a huge way in terms of implementation and maintenance, actually doing this and doing it over time. When you can make it work for you and your class and your kids, as a teacher, you're much more likely to stick with it. But I also think that there's a greater, some level of individualization is going to make it more effective for the students too. So when it's done right, I think it's a real win-win. The issue is we're really just starting to study and think about how to do this. And so I think that knowledge base and evidence base is still emerging.
Thank you. So as we're coming to a close, I want to thank you so much. I encourage our listeners to really engage with the whole issue and especially the feature article as well. Before we go, one, thank you for so much for being here, spending time with us today. But I want you to either answer one of these questions, and you can pick which one you want to answer. But I think classrooms are such a magical place, right? We ask students to take risks. We have them learn and evolve and become the people that they want to become. And what I love about evidence-based practices is it brings effectiveness to our practice. What do you love about them? What brings you passion about doing this work? Second is another option, like to give people choices. You all are accomplished researchers, and what I've learned about being in the field is that there's always something to learn. So, what should educators be looking for in the future?
I think I always think back now because I'm no longer in my, secondary classroom. And I think back and I think, wow, if I knew then what I know now, would be such a better teacher. And I think, like I was, my experiences in a co-taught classroom, I loved it. I loved co-teaching. I think I had several areas where I'm proud of what, I did as a secondary teacher, but I think in high school, one of my biggest challenges is like, I think me and my co-teacher were really good at being able to provide all students with access, right, to that general ed curriculum and being able to kind of think about UDL or accommodations to give them the access. But I think in high school, what I was really missing is like, how do I really improve reading outcomes? Like when we're talking about students reading 4 or 5 grade levels below, what do I need to be doing in that inclusive setting on a daily basis, right? To make sure that really meaningful gains are being made. And that's where evidence-based practices come in, right? And I think just having access to evidence-based practices and thinking about how, that specialized instruction designed to meet the individual needs of the students, that's the cornerstone of IDEA, right? And so I think we really need to like think about what we're choosing when we're working on student IEP goals and objectives. And so I think that's to me why it's really important to understand and use those practices in our classroom.
You're accomplished researchers, and what I have learned about being in the field is that there's always something to learn. What should educators be looking for in the future?
I think plenty of things to look forward to in the future, I hope. But related to evidence-based practice, I think what we've done so far as a field it has been a big step about trying to synthesizing the research to identify these practices that are supported by bodies of rigorous experimental research. That's a great tool to have for policymakers, educators, parents, but it paints with a very broad brush, and it identifies practices that are generally effective for broad groups of learners, typically for broad outcome areas. And I think that's just not the type of, it's a great starting place, but I think most educators are interested more, is this practice, what version of this practice is going to work for this kid in this setting for this specific outcome? And I think those granular types of information that thinking about the boundaries of effectiveness for what versions of an intervention are effective for this type of learner, but not that type of learner, and in this context, but not that context, and for this type of outcome and not that type of outcome. You can imagine almost for every practice, this huge grid of all the different outcomes and student types and conditions that it may be taught under. And I think at some point we get much more nuanced about all of this, and we start thinking not so much about what is what works, but what versions of practices work for which learners, for which outcomes, under what conditions, which is a much more nuanced and complicated question.
So when I think about what we want teachers and teacher educators to be on the lookout for, one idea that I think is really important to keep in mind is that the research base is constantly evolving, right? So even since we conceptualized this issue submitted it, right? There's a pretty decent delay, and more reviews have likely come out. More individual studies that could then be included in later reviews might come out. So one thing to be on the lookout for is practices that, may have, when we were doing our first analysis of the data, might have come out to be promising practices, right? Or having insufficient evidence. But since then, maybe more evidence has evolved and now they're evidence-based practices, right? So that's one thing that people can be on the lookout for. But as I think about, the future, right? I think sometimes you can get caught up in this idea of like, what's the next best thing? Right? What's going to be the next best thing? And as I was thinking about this, I thought about this phrase that my grandma used to say to me when I would just be like playing with her jewelry. And I shouldn't say playing, I was in my 20s. So going through her jewelry to find jewelry to like wear out on a Friday night or something. And she would say, she'd be so shocked that I was reaching for something that was old and pulling it back out. And she'd say, oh, well, what's old becomes new again, and she'd be so thrilled. But I think that in the field of education, we've got a lot of practices, right, that are really effective for kids. And unfortunately, we have not done a great job of getting that information to teachers in a way that's accessible and providing them with the training that they need to implement them. So I think rather than maybe being on the lookout for the new thing, think about what are some practices when I look at this list, or when I look at some of these resources, what are some practices that are new to me that have evidence? Or, like I mentioned before, what are some practices that I had forgotten about? Right? Or maybe I've been trying to use these, but I don't think it's quite going the way it was intended. So where can I shore up my implementation of it? That's what I really think should be the focus, rather than necessarily thinking about when's the next best thing going to hit the market, or come out that we can use, because we've got a lot of really good stuff out there already.
Yeah, I mean, thinking about also like that reflective piece, right? Of just being able to really think about the work that you're doing. I still do. I mean, on my commute home is when I think and replay lessons in my head and think about, oh my gosh, I should have said that next time I'm going to do this, and the next time I run this lesson I'm going to change this, and this is, and I'm going to say this and emphasize this, and I want the students to do X, Y, and Z. And so much, right, of like taking what we know already and just reflecting on it as well.
Oh, is that as you look at the list of practices we have in tables one and two, there might be some things that you're wondering, like, why aren't those on there? Right? Things like direct instruction, explicit systematic phonics instruction, things like that. And one thing to keep in mind is that this article highlights and features what we define to be targeted evidence-based practices, right? Or evidence-based practices. Let me repeat that. Highlights practices that were found to be evidence-based practices through targeted evidence-based reviews. So some of the broader instructional approaches, right, like explicit instruction, may not be on this list. That does not mean that we don't want teachers using them. There is still overwhelming evidence to support the use of those tried and true instructional approaches. I don't know if Sarah or Brian would like to elaborate or say what I just said more eloquently.
No, I think just to add to that, though, as we're looking through the list, you'll see that explicit instruction is embedded into many of these practices. So I think we can all agree that explicit instruction is an evidence-based instructional approach. And new evidence-based reviews aren't being conducted on it because we know, right? It's already been established as such. So yeah, thanks for pointing that out, Lauren.
I think it's a really good point to use these reviews as a tool and as a guide, but realize we don't have evidence-based reviews done on every practice. We don't have sufficient evidence to conduct a meaningful evidence-based review on every practice. So it's really nice to have these kind of lists that can maybe be a good starting point. But back to the point that we've talked about previously, that we shouldn't let lists or identifications of evidence-based practice constrain our teaching or to limit us in terms of what we can do, and we still should rely on what the research in general talks about, our own experience, our own insights, our own expertise as educators. These things should all be working in concert. So yeah, thinking of these lists as a helpful tool, but not something that we should be constrained by.
Well, thank you all for being here and spending this time. I'm super excited for this issue, and thank you for your work and for what you're doing to advance the field. We educators all around the country are so grateful for your work. So thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for listening to the Teaching Exceptional Children's podcast. Make sure to check us out and follow our social media accounts listed in the show notes. Also, if you enjoyed this podcast, make sure to rate us and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google Podcasts. Be on the lookout for our next episode to drop, and until then, happy teaching!